Welcome to Because and Effect, a podcast from the Winnipeg Foundation, where we talk to people about the causes they care about and the effect that it has on their lives. My name is Nolan Bicknell. My guest today is Shireen Dineto. Shireen is the executive director of the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization of Manitoba, also known as IRCOM. Shireen and I sat down to talk about her work helping families integrate into Canadian society, the barriers involved in doing so, and what we can do to prepare for the inevitable increase in demand of our systems when the global refugee crisis continues to grow. Thank you for listening to the Because and Effect podcast. My name is Nolan Bicknell, and I'm joining you at the IRCOM offices downtown, or where is this called, downtown?
Sure it is.
By Shireen Dineto, the executive director of IRCOM. Shireen, thank you for joining us on the Because and Effect podcast.
Happy to be here, Nolan.
So IRCOM stands for the Immigrant Refugee Community Organization of Manitoba, but for our listeners who haven't heard about it, maybe just give me the quick 30-second breakdown of who you are, what you do, and why.
Sure. My name is Shireen Dineto, and I am the executive director at IRCOM. We have been in the inner city for 30 years now, just a little over 30 years. We serve newcomer families to Canada, and we provide them with safe, affordable, transitional housing for their first 3 years here in our beautiful city. And in that time, they receive holistic wraparound services, and our goal is to build, you know, a sense of Canadian society and understanding, you know, our their kids are in school and they know how to rent a place, or and then they move out and successfully integrate into the broader community.
Very cool. So on this coming June 30th, you guys are having an annual celebration just to celebrate IRCOM and gather all your friends and family and everything. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but for now, I just wanted to talk about the work that you are doing. You've been doing this for a long time. Maybe give a little bit of history of your role as executive director, and you, because you've been with IRCOM beforehand, and just kind of break that down for us a little bit.
Sure. Well, I was started at IRCOM in around 2013, and began as a director of programming. I was really attracted to the mission of IRCOM, that sense of building community, the commitment to community engagement. So it was a very interesting place to, and I was very attracted to work here. I was here for many years, and then during the pandemic, you know, you have sort of a, you know, you think about a lot of things, and I wanted to, you know, take a break. I went to a wonderful organization in the sector, but when the executive director position came open, I applied and was successful, and that's been about the last year and 9 months.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. What has been something that, since taking over this job, surprised you about being an executive director? Was there anything, or you kind of expected everything to be how it was?
Oh, I thought it'd be a lot easier.
Yeah, I understand that. What's your day-to-day? Like, what are you spending most of your time doing? Is it just taking meetings and what are you trying to spend your time doing these days?
Sure. And, you know, when I say I thought it would be easier, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but it still is a really complex job, and you're trying to do a bit of everything, but also keep your eyes on the most important things that I should be doing in my role, and not, you know, doing everyone else's roles, right? I try to be accessible to the team. I try to focus on our big projects. This job is also very outward looking, so partnerships and community engagement is really important. Fund development, you know, as the executive director, that's a major responsibility. Mm-hmm. And of course, I work with the board. We have a really wonderful board here at IRCOM, very supportive, very representative of our community. That's changed over the years. Mm. And it's our job to work together with the team. And we have a strategic plan. And, you know, some organizations, their strategic plan sits on the shelf and collects dust. At IRCOM, it's alive. It's a living document. And we really try to be forward thinking.
It has to be, because every day is different, and every week you're probably tasked with a new problem, or like a new, you know, not problem necessarily, but just like a new task that you have to do, because all the families that are coming to you, probably every single family is going to be different, and every single situation is going to have a different set of needs. So like, how do you wrangle all of those topics and try to just keep everything, you know, under control when there's so many different, you know, you're probably being pulled in so many different directions and you have to be a little bit of an expert in so many different areas. Like, how do you control that? How do you handle that aspect of things?
I'd like to say I'm handling it.
Well, for sure.
It's busy because you want to be responsive to partners. We get offers to partner programmatically. You know, can we, environmental groups love to work with us and newcomers, and it's an amazing opportunity. Arts organizations, you name it, right? And then we have researchers. Researchers want to learn about refugees, and we like to support learning in the community. So then, but honestly, we get offers and requests every week, and so we have to sort of assess, and we have to understand that we're also serving, we're a frontline serving organization. So some of what I do is just helping us sort through all of that and prioritize the things that we need to prioritize.
Yeah. Being pulled in so many different directions. So what is a direction for the next couple years that you and the board and your team are wanting to focus on that might be a new direction or a slightly different angle? Or is there something coming down the pipe that you're just like, okay, we got to go in this direction for a bit because of what our families are telling us?
Sure. I mean, some of it is organizational, because if you strengthen the organization, you give better service, right? We want to strengthen a few areas, one of which is Indigenous newcomer relationships, which we've been working on for over a decade. And we've been, you know, following that journey of truth and reconciliation, and we've had great support from Indigenous knowledge keepers and elders and partners. So that's really important to us because we want our families, so they're all brand new to Canada, may not have had access to information about the history of colonization, like definitely no access to that history, and also to the positive, you know, thriving Indigenous cultures all around us, right? Mm-hmm. So our job, we work with families who are brand new to Canada, so we feel it's our part of our mission to make sure that they have good exposure, you know, good understandings, and so we work really hard at that, and it's a strategic priority of IRCOM. We want people, and as soon as you start, again, we have great support from community Indigenous partners, our families, it resonates with them. Some are actually Indigenous in their own lands. They've experienced colonization in terms of strengths, you know, from traditional practices or drumming. I mean, it resonates with our families, and the work is actually easier than you would think, right? And it's very joyous, I would say. So that's a major area we work on at IRCOM. I'd say another area is every executive director that I know is building financial sustainability. We would like to really work on some areas that we're not so good at. You know, other agencies have a gala dinner or a golf tournament or a run for rights. We don't do that. And we feel like we should start to build our confidence in those areas and explore, you know, engaging more supporters, more donors, more friends.
Very cool. Just expanding the tent, you know, making the tent a little bit bigger, inviting more people in.
Yeah.
Very cool. So you've been working in this space, you know, for a very long time, sort of social work. Is that an accurate statement? You've been doing
That's my credentials. I'm a social worker and very proud of it.
Yeah. So you started how long ago?
In social work?
Yeah.
It's been 30 years, right. I would say, over 30 years.
McMaster University, was it, right? Or did I remember that right?
My undergrad was McMaster, and I did my master's of social work at Carleton in Ottawa.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. How has the institutional knowledge of social work changed since you were in school versus now? Like, what are some of the areas that people are now focusing on where in school you weren't even taught that that was a concept that you should worry about yet? Is there anything new that's come out in the last couple of 10 years even that social work has advanced on, or has it been pretty consistent since you've started?
That's a great question. I think the basic principles of social work, the way I was taught it, are fairly, there are different kinds of social work, but at Carleton, they focused on structural social work, they called it. And so they're looking at not just individual change, but also community change and systems and structures. So it's very holistic. And to be honest, it really fits with me and who I am. So I would say what has changed is more so you know, what are the kinds of things you're talking about in systems? So, of course, there's a lot more discussion about anti-racism, anti-Black racism, anti-Indigenous racism, as an example, that would not have been talked about, you know, 30 years ago. I think feminism was always there, but feminism evolved. So those kinds of areas of awareness and social justice, they are embedded in social work, you know, teaching and practice, but yeah, the topics have changed and our awareness levels have changed.
As culture evolves, so too does the work surrounding social awareness, I guess, yeah. So another question I had was, this is a huge question, but we'll go with it. What structures or systems don't exist that should, and what systems currently exist that need to be restructured? That's a big one.
That's a huge one.
So I actually had that last, but I skipped ahead because you talked about the structure of it. Yeah.
You know, a lot of systems and structures, okay, to be frank, I think they need a reset. And I think there's widespread agreement across the sector, across many sectors, because we're partners with inner city organizations, with settlement organizations, and so on, right? Youth serving organizations. You know, we work with really great, you know, project officers, program officers. I've met some of the, you know, the deputy ministers, everyone individually, I find really, you know, on board, doing things for the right reasons,
right place,
but there's something about the systems that gets in the way, and there are things about the systems that perpetuate themselves. So, as you know, systems impact people. You know, they impact people's daily lives. So we have youth facing a lot of racism, and it could be whether it's in the educational system or it's policing, healthcare. You know, recently had a you know, heard of an experience where, you know, you can see racial differential treatment of racial groups in the healthcare system. So all of these systems, I hate to say all of these systems, well, but you
know, majority even, yeah.
The many systems, I think, need change. They need new policies. We need to look to other places, other countries, other cities. Some cities are doing really innovative stuff. And change things up.
Yeah, I'm thinking about this constantly just from a foundation perspective and what we are trying to do and evolve. And like, is the problem that the systems need to be adjusted or just scrapped altogether? You know, like there's kind of there's so many different layers to the onion, as it were. And like, I'm curious your perspective of like, at what point do we just kind of like start from scratch, and how hard is that even to do? But like, there needs to be kind of a reset of things based on new priorities, based on new wisdom and new knowledge. And it just seems as though we're kind of just driving the ship in the same direction, and you know, it changes 1 or 2 degrees, but we need a full 90 degree right turn on some things. So like, what is the strategy to, is it just get as many partners as you can and try to have conversations and try to sway the ship to move? Or is it, we need to do something drastic? Like, what is the goal for someone who realizes that things can't keep going this way, but I don't even know where to begin?
Right. So big questions. I think, I mean, one, for your own sanity, for our own sanity, we do have to focus on what we do it well, and understand that we're making a difference. So yesterday I was giving a presentation to new staff on the global context of refugees, and it's overwhelming. Right now there are over 100 million displaced people worldwide. That's just this overwhelming reality, and there's a global refugee crisis, right? So, you know, after I said to the new staff, I said, the point of this is not to overwhelm you. Part of what we can all take comfort in is that we're making a difference in people's lives, and we do have to focus on that. But in terms of, you know, IRCOM has always believed that if we only focus on that, then ultimately, you know, we're just, the conditions still perpetuate the problems, and that something needs to be done. What we tend to do is work in partnership on either sort of through networks, committees, social activism sometimes, you know, to try to change. And sometimes we focus in on certain policies, something more practical and achievable. you know, it's a bit of everything. We're on coalitions that address systemic change in education, for example. And the focus with that coalition is to look at representation. So there's many, many things you could look at in terms of educational reform. But let's look at levels of representation among TAs or EAs in the school system, teachers, among teachers who have who are subs versus full-time regular teachers. And then let's look at the administration, the school trustees, and so on, right? And the board administration and trustees.
Yeah.
And this group is doing an audit every year to, you know, to try to hold school boards and also the educational institution that train teachers, right? So that's an example of something that we're part of a collective to support.
The mindset of diversity is strength is not that it's a new concept, but there's people that I'm from a small town, so there's people who would disagree with that. And so how do you have a conversation with someone that doesn't believe that diversity is strength? What do you say to them? Or do you just not? There's another, because I was just at a conference in Toronto, and they said that don't worry about the people who aren't on your team already. Focus on the people who you are already sort of your allies. Is that maybe I'm looking at it the wrong way, but like, should we spend on time arguing with people who disagree with the fundamental like beliefs of what we're trying to achieve, or should we spend our time more on people who already are our allies and just strengthening those bonds and just strengthening those relationships? Like, is that a fair question even?
Well, I think everyone has their own journey when it comes to what you're going to take on in your life in terms of trying to change people, right? And the people around you. I know of some people in the settlement sector who've, you know, a white person who really started to want to tackle anti-racism and lost long-term friendships because of it. You know, so it can be a really difficult journey for some folks. You know, when that comes up and in front of me, because I am I'm BIPOC, and you know, it's not going to usually come straight to my face, but you pick up on it, and I think the best I can do is use the strengths-based approach, and I talk about the strengths of, you know, a diverse team here at IRCOM. The strengths and contributions of immigrants and refugees. We work with refugees, so we focus on refugees. Every talk that I give, I show a picture of our founders who were Southeast Asian refugees originally. And I also share an inventory of the occupations of our tenants. And people are usually shocked because we have doctors and bioengineers, and we have construction clerks, and we have, you know, all sorts of people with skills, experience. And you know, so it's just trying to change the discourse. I don't know if it's effective, but it's important. Yeah.
We thank you for being a part of the Winnipeg Foundation's most recent magazine. I was able to interview you and do a nice little write-up there, so thank you for that. People can find it at wpgfdn.org. But it speaks to just having these conversations sort of over and over, and the discourse that's happening, and you say when you give talks and stuff and just trying to educate things, but like, how do you stay energetic when we seem to be having the same conversations for a very long time? And it's like, I thought we settled this already. Like, why are we still debating this? You know, I don't have anything specific about like a specific example, but like, how do you stay vigilant in the mission when it's so exhausting? And I'm just looking at it from an outsider's perspective, never mind like on the inside.
Yeah. Two things, focusing on the positive and believing in the collective. Mm-hmm. That's what keeps me going anyway. So, you know, I see these little children like right outside from where we're meeting, there's a daycare, and I see their little matching vests, and I see their parents coming to pick them up, and they're outside playing, and they have come from all these different places in the world, and they're, you know, building their small little community together. And I think, you know, I see the joy in our families despite the incredible hardships. I see the, you know, the appreciation of tenants who are moving out. They will always come down, usually invite the staff up to the suite or come down and bring a nice tray of goodies and say such eloquent things about the impacts that we've had. And I would say the impacts they have on us is what keeps us going. And, you know, collectivity, I feel like, you know, every time I attend a meeting here internally or externally, you know, we develop that sense of, okay, we're all in this together. And that's, I truly mean it. I think that's kind of, you have to have that outlook, and that's what keeps you going.
That's what, yeah, no kidding. You mentioned briefly just the amount of talent of newcomers that they have. Can you talk a little bit about the red tape and the hoops that people have to jump through to have their accreditations recognized in Canada? I just find it so, talk about systems change. That could be something, maybe just talk about a little bit about, like, if someone's a doctor in their country, but they aren't allowed to practice here, and like what work needs to be done to expedite that process, and like, why is it currently in the state that it's in when someone with perfectly good skills and talents isn't allowed to use them because of some archaic system in place denying them that opportunity.
Yes. So do you really want me to get started on that topic?
Yeah, it's great. I've spoken with a few people, and it just seems like we're just shooting ourselves in the foot when it comes to a country that has people capable of doing something and the potential there, and we're just squandering all that potential. So like, what can the average person do to try to further these goals to make things better for everyone in that arena?
Well, I really think that if people are on side and they want to make a change, I think we have to talk to our politicians, first of all. So every time there's an election coming up, we should be talking to our politicians and saying, look, you know, if you're a business owner, a small business owner, and you can't get labor or you need skilled labor or whatever it is, you know, there are some easy solutions if we just expedited credential recognition, you know, and different ways of onboarding people into the workforce. So I think having a voice and making it an election issue, because to be honest, we have a lot of newcomer staff ourselves, right? And I just had at my new staff orientation, someone who's fairly new to the country asking, why doesn't Canada make this easier for us? And I was just reading an article this morning, I guess, in the news. It said about 30, they did a pool of new immigrants. About 30% are thinking of leaving Canada within the next, I think it was 2 to 5 years. 30%. What a waste. And the article highlighted a family who just same could not get their credentials recognized, this onerous, arduous process. I think I have an example of, I'll tell you about a refugee newcomer. So I was working on the weekend just doing a bit of catch up. So the regular settlement team wasn't around. So he found me. So I said, sure, I'll at least get started, you know, come on in. So he wanted to work for the Winnipeg. He wanted to work for the airport, right? Okay. So he, you know, and it's a federal, so, you know, there's a certain level of security. He needed to have documentation from his last five countries of residence. So he was originally a refugee from Sierra Leone. He had lived in Gambia. He had lived in other places, all of which were unstable, you know, situations. And just to get, you know, so that means that letters with your, you know, address on it, that's from a utilities bill or something. But he needed to look at, in 5 years, it had been about five places. So somehow he's got to find all of that. And he was a refugee. So he arrived with a small suitcase and no documentation, none of his original documentation. So for a refugee, it's even harder. So he did things like paying people that he knew, someone's cousin, someone's uncle, to go to such and such a place to go and get this letter or this, you know, never mind his actual credentials that he had to get. So, but, you know, $200 and he'd never hear from them again. Another $200, he'd never hear from them again. You know, one day he came back to me. I mean, I did hand him over to the team because this is not my area of expertise. but he kept coming back to me just to give me updates. Mm-hmm. And then he showed me finally, you know, a year later, he's got what looks like a criminal record check, clear check from one of the countries that he needed to provide. I mean, I think that man took 2-3 years before he was able to. And that's not, you know, a high. It's, and for professions, so the doors are closed. and they open a little crack, and you know, it's just this really parochial system, protective, you know, what's that word, protectionism. I don't know what it is. It's really, really bad, and it's been in place as long as my parents have been in this country, which is over 50 years.
I'm smiling because I'm thinking of my experiences needing to get documentation for job applications or whatever, and be waiting on hold and getting passed around to robot, you know, like not being able, and I speak the language of this country, you know, like it's the barriers for someone who doesn't even, you know, it's mind-boggling, and I feel so deeply for the people who have to spend their time waiting on hold, calling numbers that they're not even sure if that's the right number that we need to be calling, and jumping through hoops that are so arbitrarily unnecessary. And I understand there needs to be some process in place, yep. but the ones that are still left over from 30 years ago that don't really make, like, we need to just be maybe assessing the systems more frequently, mm-hmm. or I don't know what it is, but oh well, we've always done it that like that is not a justifiable response anymore, mm-hmm. I don't think, and it kind of used to be like, oh well, that's just how we do things here, and mm-hmm. and it's how do you not get frustrated, because even just like one day of researching a little bit of stuff for the refugee experience sent me into a blind rage, but you know, maybe you're just more zen than me, or like how do you stay calm when there's so many frustrating things in your daily experience of work? How do you stay calm?
Yeah, it is. You know, we do a lot of venting. do a lot of venting. Yeah. Our team sort of develops a lot of expertise in navigating systems, but it is that oppositional process, right? Whereas it's almost like if that whole mindset changed to facilitation, let's see, you've got this. We need this. What is our best path forward, right? Yeah. As opposed to, I need you to go and get X, Y, and Z documentation. You send it all in. Oh, you forgot this, and that takes 4 more weeks for you to get. And one person actually, it took there was so much back and forth that about a year into it, this is credential recognition, a year into it, they said, oh, sorry, all of that's expired. You have to reapply. And he was just telling me this. So yes, you walk away with a feeling of rage. but you know, I mean, you know, I was born here, so at least I don't have, but I feel for everyone. And many of our staff are in that situation, and our families are in that situation. So it's, yeah, it is very frustrating.
At the end of the day, it's just like we talk about systems, but people are the ones that are keeping the systems active or whatever, yes. Right? So like, how do we get cut through that nonsense of system reform, and you know, because it's just people at the end of the day that are perpetuating the system. So like, is it a conscious thing? Is it just kind of like, well, we've always done it that way, and that just pervasive through these areas, or like, what's the solution? What do we do?
Yeah, I wish I knew. I do think that some institutions, there isn't enough either turnover or, you know, so getting at building representation, setting targets, all of that is, I'm not saying that diversity unto itself is going to change everything, but just shaking it up,
having more perspectives,
yeah. Exactly, having people who have that lived experience of facing all the barriers, because, you know, within systems, people do get removed. That's one thing for sure. They rely on us to tell them all the issues. But, you know, it is, you know, it's interesting. The focus is often on the frontline day-to-day kinds of problems and needs and so on. But do they take that back into their systems? You know, so right. I do think sometimes it's going to be about greater diversity that'll introduce new ideas, right. Shake things up a bit. I think also there are innovative models that we can borrow from. Someone has to have the courage to fund something more than just a 1-year pilot project. Mm. That is a different way of doing things. You know, one big system is the child welfare system. Mm-hmm. And we know the damage it's done, mm-hmm. in Indigenous communities, other racialized communities. So the intent is there. Children do need protection, but the system is really unwieldy. And so there are models that are much better, that are culturally based, that keep children within, you know, a circle of community. So, yeah.
Proven models. Yep. So, yeah. The last episode was with a woman from Momaway, and she talked about the family group conference program a lot and like how the solutions are there. We just need to implement them. And it's a pretty powerful program. Shifting gears a little bit, I want to talk about when you first started this work and what it was like as a young person to be introduced to probably some pretty difficult situations. You were a crisis worker at a shelter for abused women and children. What was that like as a young person being out of school and just introduced to a very difficult and traumatic set of situations and cases, and how did that shape who you are now and who you became in the future?
Right, right. You know, well, I might have told you that my undergrad was a biopsych degree. And, you know, my parents, who did want the best for me, wanted me to probably be a doctor. I mean, not probably. They definitely wished me to be a doctor. Yes.
Told me that.
So, but, you know, they also grew and changed as I did. But my friend was working in the women's community, and another friend got a job at this shelter. So I applied.
This is Montreal?
This is Hamilton.
Or Hamilton. Interval
House of Hamilton. And, you know, at that time, we could be trained on the job. And it was hard. It was hard work. We worked usually officially 12-hour shifts, but usually 13 hours. You had to do a handover with a, you know, day shift, night shift. It was intense. But I also felt I'd found the right profession, and that's why I went back and did my master's of social work. It was an amazing experience, and it was eye-opening in some ways, although, you know, I don't think I was a stranger to those kinds of family situations, so there's a reason why this was really important to me. But it was those early days of learning about feminism, for example. Mm. So I think it was really just foundational for me. And to feel like you were providing refuge for women escaping the most incredibly terrible situations. Women sleeping in cars, and their furniture had been thrown all over the place, and their clothing all cut up, and they were calling us, you know, they were sleeping, and there's no cell phones in those days. They were calling us from a payphone, and their children in the back of the car, and you could say, you can come here. You can come here to this place, and I will meet you at the door. And we had, you know, clothes, and we had food. We had a cook who cooked for our families. It was an amazing thing to be a part of, but it was a really tough job. Yeah.
Well, it just introduces you to the wide spectrum of human potential and situations that you're going to come across. You mentioned a little bit earlier just sort of the youth and the youth perspective. I wonder, both from a hiring perspective and just from a general sort of, not wisdom because they're youth, but I mean, there is something, I don't know how to describe it, but every time I'm introduced with like a youth in philanthropy or anyone that's like born after the year 2000, there's a special kind of a look in their eyes where they don't take no for an answer. You know, like they have an inspiration that I walk away with that is just so profound and makes me very optimistic about the future because they have this new way of doing things. I just wonder your perspective from some of your staff and just from people that you've interacted with. What are the youth like that you work with at IRCOM, or some of the families that you help out? Just what's your perspective on the youth that you get to interact with on a day-to-day basis?
Sure, sure. Oh, you know, I feel so much hope. It's delightful to have we have a multi-generational workplace, meaning actually the people we serve are from, you know, newborns to parents who are elderly sometimes. But having youth on site and working with youth, our after school programs provide all sorts of supports and services for our youth. They are wonderful. They have energy, they have optimism, and they have such strength. Refugee kids, you know,
next level.
You know what it's like to be a teenager. So imagine, it's hard as it is, even when you're born here and brought up here. So they're usually, they have to jump into high school. They have to jump into the same grade based on their age level. So, but some kids have had interrupted schooling. It's this incredible uphill battle, and you should see them. I mean, I go to homework program. The kids are there every night after school, including a Friday night, you know, and getting help and working away at their stuff. Many of our youth get scholarships, some from us, but many from, you know, from universities. We have a really high graduation rate, you know, probably about 75-85% of our youth graduate every year. Huge. I'm going to find out what the stats are for this year.
Cool.
And we have at our celebration next week, we're going to have a presentation at the end of it where all the youth who receive scholarships are up on the stage and getting so acknowledged good. For that. Our youth also excel in other areas, sports, you know. IRCOMS, I had to do a little shout out to we have three youth soccer teams, U16, U17 boys, and U15 girls. Two of our teams won the city championships this year. So,
Unreal. You
know, imagine, you know, the drive and imagine, you know, the desire to excel and to make it. And I'm not saying every kid, you know, that's not the only metric is, you know, excelling in scholarships.
For sure.
I have a new staff, but she's, you know, very young as well. And she was asking me all these questions. She was saying, so IRCOM serves families, right? So why, what if a young, like a refugee, young person comes here as a single? Are you going to say no to them? And I had to say,
that's the attitude I love.
I had to say, yeah. Well, actually, you know, it's not our mission, right. But we would obviously have them, you know, bring them in to at least, you know, help them and find the right place to. And I had, and she said, okay, you have a family here and one of their kids, you know, is 21 years old. Would you kick them out? And I had to explain, no, once you're part of the family, even if you're over 18, of course, you can still live here at IRCOM. But these are really great questions. And then she said, after I answered, you know, trying to define our mission, right, and what we can and cannot do, she said, is there any interest in changing the mission to include some of these, you know, kids who come alone? And I said, you know, is no such thing as never. Mm-hmm. So that's the attitude I think that you're talking about, which is asking lots of questions and being pretty fearless.
Yes.
And I love it. Yeah.
And just constantly assessing systems and why do we do things this way? And it's tough when you have an organization that has only people born at, you know, in before the 90s, because there's just a limited scope of thought and process that our generation has. Everything that I read, everything that I see says that the crisis is not going to go away when it comes to refugee crisis and the global sort of climate change and everything that's going to displace human beings. This is another big question. I'm asking a lot of big ones, but what does Winnipeg need to do to prepare as a city for the future of increased volume of all the things that you're working on a day-to-day basis? What does the city or the province or even just the average person need to do to prepare for the future that's coming, the inevitability of it?
Yes, it is inevitable. I agree. I think one, we have to trust that there are processes in place. So, there's sort of a misunderstanding that there's some kind of free-for-all and there's always a refugee determination system, and actually the vast majority of folks are actually coming through the government assisted program or the private sponsorship programs, right? Mm-hmm. which are very engaged programs. But I would say, okay, if I could, you know, I do think our municipal government has to get involved in immigration. In some of the bigger cities they are. And
that's where people come to the hubs.
Yeah.
People come to the big cities.
Yeah. And in, you know, I think again, it's about change, and this is the way we've always done things. Immigration is not a municipal concern. I would love for the folks in city council to think about the ways that we can support newcomers. I don't think it's, there's a newcomer inclusion policy that's been put forward, and I think that needs to be given some funding and some support, because the city is a huge employer, for example, you know, and we can provide lots of opportunities for integrating newcomers. Mm-hmm. This is not just about making our services. We can also make our services more accessible, which I think the city is working on. So I think a change in mindset at the municipal level would be good, so mm-hmm. that we can all three levels of government are working together at supporting newcomers. And then I think in terms of the sector or the sectors, I think look at who you serve, and are you serving are you serving a really diverse base of people? If not, start partnering and learning about how to work effectively, how to provide safe, culturally accessible, trauma-informed services. Many of us know how to do that for maybe a specific population, but we should start thinking about global populations. I think we can be welcoming. We've got great services. We just have to prepare ourselves.
Beautifully said. So if someone's listening out there, you have an event on the 30th. Is there going to be some information passed along? Is it just a celebration? Like, what can people expect at your annual shindig on Friday?
Sure. Well, we often say that IRCOM is like a mini United Nations, right? So you're going to see all our attendant families from 21 different countries from around the world celebrating. Many of our families dress up beautifully, and our tenants, we have a tenant named Mohammed. He's an amazing drummer, Syrian drummer, and it's a party when he gets up on the stage.
Nice.
We're having hoop dancers who are coming through our good friend, knowledge keeper Clayton Sandy.
Cool.
So we're going to have dancers from Rwanda. So of course it's a celebration of culture and multiculturalism, and there will be a lot of fun stuff for kids. So we encourage people to come with their families. Everyone's welcome. There'll be free food. I was just describing this to Blaine, who's bringing the hoop dancers, that we have shawarma, and he's never tried shawarma before.
Oh, wow.
And I said, I'm pretty sure you're gonna like it. So we'll have food, entertainment, bouncy castle, dunk tank. So if you know any IRCOM staff and you'd like to see them dropped into a pot of really freezing cold water, do come by.
Awesome.
And we also are definitely encouraging people. We're going to have a table, so if people would like to be a part of our community and volunteer,
cool.
There'll be an information table, or if someone wants to find out about tenancy, they can come by. And, we're a nonprofit charitable organization. We're always open to accepting donations.
Fantastic.
As well.
So is that at this location?
Yep.
215 Isabel?
No, sorry. It's at 95 Allen.
Oh, 95 sorry. Allen. Okay,
it's
cool.
It's our original site.
Okay.
That was built just, a little over 30 years ago.
Awesome. Well, happy birthday. And so that's Friday, June 30th at 95 Allen.
At 95 Allen, okay. From 4 till 8 p.m.
Beautiful. Is there anything else that you would like to talk about that either that's coming up in the next couple of years, or just something that came across your desk recently, or something that you think that the people of Winnipeg should know about your work at IRCOM?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that Winnipeggers empathize, and the response of Winnipeggers when certain events around the world, sort of hit the news is quite amazing. And people open their hearts, and I think that's really something special about Winnipeg, and probably all of Manitoba. I think we also are actually known around the world for our private sponsorship program.
Mm.
We have been the biggest private sponsorship of refugees program in Canada.
Is that Ukraine mostly, or like what,
before the Ukraine?
Oh, wow.
We had these founders in our community who said, this is let's try this model of it could be a group of five, five community members who get together, churches, mosques, different religious organizations, community organizations get together and sponsor refugees. It's this incredibly meaningful experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes lives, both the sponsoring group and the refugees.
For sure.
Yeah, I just think I have a lot of faith in our community, and I think, I encourage people not to fall for the really negative discourse. I think any given topic right now, there's either a right or a wrong way, or people are very divided or divisive. Open your hearts, see people as people, as human beings, and I think that's the way you make a difference in this world.
Beautifully said. At the end of our time together, we do a little section called Just Because. It's 7 questions about the causes you care about and the effect that it's had in your life, thus the Cause and Effect podcast. Are you okay to go through those with us?
Sure.
Kind of like quick, okay. Like a lightning round almost. Question one, what's the very first cause you ever remember caring about?
Women's rights.
Even as like a child? Or like as a young adult?
You know what?
Yeah?
Yes.
Nice. Like
fairness or unfairness? Because when you let's be real, you grow up in a family, you see unfair and fair things happening, unfair things, and it would bother me, you know. And so, yeah.
Do you have siblings?
I have siblings.
That's usually when the unfairness.
I have a sibling. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes you see traditional interactions in families and you think, why is it this way? You know, or, you know, and also I would say, you know, okay, I was good in math and physics, for example. Uh-huh. Grade 13, which is dating me. So this is Ontario. We had grade 13 a million years ago. I did really well in physics, but the favorites were these boys who were at the front of the room, right? They were the favorites. They were asked questions. The teacher joked with them. It was like this camaraderie and all the rest of it. So in the back, somewhere in the back, I'm there, you know, doing really well. The very last day of school, the teacher came up to me and said, hey, have you ever thought about going into university for engineering? And I had never had that thought because I didn't have that encouragement. And you know, yeah. So women's rights, that's
love it.
Always been important to me.
Hell yeah. Question two, if money and politics and logistics were no issue at all, you can just snap your fingers and something would happen. What would you do in support of your current cause?
I would, you know what? I would fund, have someone fund, you know, yeah, alternative systems or alternative, we were talking about it.
Like system
reform? A totally different way of doing something and pilot it and show the world that you can do things differently and look at the results. Because I 100% believe, like, let's say we take a group of people and we expedite their credential recognition and look at them in 2 years, functioning, thriving, paying taxes, all those good things. That's what I'd like to do.
Yeah. Beautiful. Question three, what's the biggest misunderstanding or the biggest stigma about your cause?
You know, as we talked about, I think it is negative connotations around being a refugee. There's myths about being queue jumpers, as they used to say. I think, you know, that's what I would like to, that refugees, one, it's not something that defines you. It's something that happened to you. And two, that refugees come with a lot of strengths and determination and smarts. And I see it every day.
Yeah, strength-based programming. And
yeah.
I hear that a lot and it's something we need to focus on. Yeah. Question four, what is a recent victory, either personally or professionally, that you can share with us? So, like a recent dub that you've gotten?
Well, we just had a donation come to us from an individual donor, and it was our single largest individual donation that we've ever received. And it was really supported by a board member that the individual knew, and it was such a thrill. The whole team is happy. And it's a recognition, you know, of the work we do and how it touches people's lives.
So affirming.
Very happy.
Affirming of the mission, affirming of everything.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Question five. What is the best piece of advice that you've ever been given?
Do you want to know what it is?
Please.
It was in university and it was not everything is about you. And so I was insecure. I think I would say I was an insecure teenager. I was an insecure sort of young adult. And I probably spent far too much time thinking about what everyone else was thinking about me and thinking it was all about me in the end. And my roommate, who was just blunt, and she just one day she said, you know, not everything is about you. And of course I was hurt and I walked around with this for a while, but it changed my life. I realized, wow, I am spending far too much time worrying about what everyone else thinks about me, and I'm really not actually that bad a person nor that insufficient a person. And I think it helped switch my thinking to much more of a from cup is half empty to, you know, the glass is half full.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. I love it. Question six, staying on the advice train, what advice would you give your 10-year-old self if you could talk to her?
Well, I would say, you know, have faith in yourself and that the world is a beautiful place, and you just have to find your place in it, and that you will, and that you'll have company along the way, and you'll have community and family along the way.
Find your place, find your people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Beautiful. Last question is the hardest one. What do you, Shireen, want to be remembered for?
Oh my goodness. I would like to be remembered for being kind, being open, and hopefully creating a place where people have thrived and grown, and also, you know, really enjoyed being Canadians and being part of something that's really bigger than themselves.
Beautifully said, Shireen Donato, Executive Director of IRCOM. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for the interview, for the magazine, and for the podcast today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, Nolan. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you to Shireen and to her team for hosting me for this lovely chat at IRCOM's offices. And as mentioned, they are having their annual celebration this Friday in Winnipeg. You can learn more at IRCOM.ca. All music on our show is produced by Trenton Burton. You can search more of his music by searching Trenton Burton on Spotify. Because and Effect is a podcast of the Winnipeg Foundation. To learn more about the Foundation, you can follow us at WPGFDN on all social media outlets. I'm at Nolan Bicknell on all social media outlets as well. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. We'll see you next week, same time, same place. And remember, a refugee is someone who survived and who can create the future. Bye-bye.